Diplomacy is back at the center of our foreign policy.
My style in diplomacy is my style as a human being.
Diplomacy, John, the job of statesmen.
And I thought it was drinking and dancing.
And so Aaron Sorkin's West Wing offered its own take on what makes diplomacy matter in our modern world, which is what we'd like to explore over the next 4 weeks. Can diplomats really make our world safer? Modern diplomacy is currently experiencing fundamental changes at an unprecedented rate, which affects the very character of diplomacy as we know it, the so-called CNN factor. Soldiers, even celebrities like George Clooney and Angelina Jolie, enter the fray these days, edging the diplomats often to the sidelines. We'll meet four Australians, all dedicated diplomats, to hear why they think their craft matters so much, how they saw their job. Today, John McCarthy, one of our most celebrated diplomats who continues to contribute to the public conversation around what's available to us as a nation as we try to deal with this turbulent world, he joins us, and I was pleased he could.
A great pleasure, Geraldine.
What sort of personal definition of diplomacy carried you throughout your career, I wonder?
Look, essentially, first of all, getting to know the countries with which you're dealing. Secondly, trying to represent Australian interests. But thirdly, and this is crucially important, trying to feed back to Australia your perceptions of the country.
Yeah, I detect from you that that's actually harder, maybe, than the other part of the job.
Well, I think it often is. We don't have a government and institutions like the British or the French or the Americans with a long history of overseas interaction on crucial issues. A lot of it, you know, until the 40s, until the war, Second World War, you know, was essentially handled by the British. So it's quite novel in our system to have to really understand international politics at a very high level, particularly on issues which have, you know, crucial importance to us. You know, our politicians aren't seasoned in the same way as, say, the Americans or the Europeans or even some of the Asians, say, particularly the Japanese. So I think that that is an important part of one's work as a diplomat, as an Australian diplomat.
Almost a sort of education process, by the sound of you.
Yes, that sounds a touch condescending, but there's an element of that in it, yeah.
And I wonder whether you're also dealing with two new factors that several of the people who write about it are suggesting. There's the what they call the CNN factor, or, you know, the role of the media as a new actor in this, and also that specialists in the information world, the technical revolution, are brought in to advise maybe on specific issues rather than diplomats. So that in a sense, you're being disrupted. Diplomacy is being disrupted.
Well, good diplomats always try and deal with the new. The CNN factor, I mean, really came to the fore with Vietnam. And I think most, you know, good diplomats who've been around since then understand the CNN factor and the fact that, you know, images are going back, which sometimes can be misunderstood in your home capital, and the importance of interpreting that. And of course, also the fact that news just happens faster. There are more events that are in front of people than there once were. The technical aspect, yeah, I understand what you're saying. There are far more players in the space. Again, you know, if you want to get your views across, it's very important for a good diplomat to understand that that information is also around you and you seek to influence that information. Now, I've always found in my posts it's very important to interact with the Australian media because you want them to get the correct messages going back. The other crucial factor, you know, which has increased, I think, in the last 30 or 40 years, is influencing the media in the foreign country to which you're accredited. That side of the job is hugely important.
Ah, tell me more, please, about that.
Well, look, I can give you probably two examples which are personal experience for me. One was Indonesia, where one of the key factors in the relationship between Australians and Indonesians is the very active media you have on both sides. Mm. So if you're doing your job properly in a place like Jakarta, you really have to get out and try and influence Indonesian media. Sometimes it doesn't work. I mean, you know, we tried very hard during the Timor crisis in Jakarta to get people to understand our perspective, and it was really drowned out by everything that was coming from within Jakarta. But worth doing.
And you were in India too at a very, very difficult stage. And I remember your statements at the time when all of those acts of violence were being committed, many of them or several of them on Indian students. And I remember you saying at the time, John, I think we've put back our relations possibly a generation.
Yeah, well, I think that was probably overly pessimistic, but I wouldn't want to be around if we had another set of those instances. I think the reaction would be quite sharp in India, and it would be because of the previous history would be part of it. But there, I think I and my successor, Peter Varghese, and our teams, and that included people from Australia, were actually quite effective in getting a message out which showed that this was what was happening in Australia in terms of bashing of Indian students, and that's what it was irregular. It just wasn't a normal pattern. And I think for that reason, we were able to get things back to normal in terms of students going back to Australia quite quickly.
I suppose it's sometimes diplomacy can seem incredibly abstract, you know, much less abstract than cyber issues, for instance, you know, or health issues as we're going through at the moment, or control of information and AI. I wonder whether diplomats know how to persuade their home population, you know, who after all matter in terms of attitudes when budgets are handed out, that they are still crucial to the maintenance of peace.
Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe we're at fault on that. The hard thing about it, though, is people only get interested in it when there's a crisis.
Yes.
And in our system, it is very hard to project the understanding that there is an awful lot of work out there which is largely unnoticed. And that's not just what you do in embassies. It's getting ministers going through to difficult places. I mean, we have a tendency in our system to prefer Washington, London to, and maybe Tokyo, to the harder places. And I think that really has to shift.
Can you see any sense that that might happen? Because after all, as I understand it, we're pulling people out of whole regions because we don't feel that we have the ability to service them properly.
Well, one can go on forever about the shortage of funds in DFAT. It's not that DFAT isn't getting funds for particular purposes. For example, money to put into Indonesia for COVID-19, and I hope new money to put into India for COVID-19. Mm. It's simply keeping the system going at a serious and responsible level. And that's, I think, probably our three or four key posts in Asia are actually okay. That's a personal view. Where we tend to be very underdone is some of the smaller places or medium places in Asia. And I think we've really lost sight of the need for properly staffed missions in Europe and in what used to be called the Third World. I think there, you know, there is a need, particularly if we are looking to the Europeans for more support in the Indo-Pacific, I think we need to put more staff in. We've stripped them away dramatically in the last generation or so.
Do you think the best and the brightest still want to go into diplomacy, or which used to be the case, or do you think it's shifting?
Look, they get a very good intake, but when I first joined and looked at the people who had joined between the Second World War and when I joined in the late 60s, there were a huge number of Rhodes Scholars that picked DFAT as their first choice. I don't think you'd find that now. I think they'd probably go into banks, law firms to a greater extent. There are a few, but I don't think it's as attractive because I think young people pick up from others what their prospects are when they get into the system. And although there are some really glamorous and interesting work from time to time, there's also an awful lot of drudgery. And I think they also pick up that the DFAT and the foreign policy system just isn't held in quite the same regard by government as it once was.
But why do you think
that's regrettable?
Why do you think that is the case?
I think one of the problems with international relations, unlike difficult economics or unlike, you know, health issues, is that politicians feel that, you know, as long as they read the papers, they can kind of pick it up. You look at other governments and other systems, their ministers have very often, and this is in bigger countries, have had a huge experience in the foreign policy space, either because of work over a very long period on congressional or parliamentary committees, or because they work in systems where the foreign minister and people in analogous ministries tend to be drawn from the technical side, from people who, you know, worked in these spaces all their lives. So, you know, all that adds up to a tendency, I think, to think, okay, we know we've got to be careful with words, but I think we've got it. I would say, quite frankly, I think in Australia that's led to a certain arrogance, a certain sense with elected officials that they sort of know it and they don't need too much advice.
Well, in fact, in some of your latest writings about the way we are thinking about some of the challenges, and you're particularly thinking about China, but I think you mean beyond China, and it's pretty blunt from you, talking about the words that are used like balance of freedoms and how we're going to make sure we stand up for our sovereignty. You say, well, yes, all right, but beyond the obvious point that some of our actions are costing us money and jobs, sensibly run countries do not burn their bridges, and where necessary, they hedge. Not good chest-beating material, but smarter. Now, clearly foreign policy has been brought into domestic political issues at the moment in Australia. I think probably a lot of people would agree to that. With that, that must make things tougher for diplomats on the ground.
Oh, I'm sure it does. You know, the famous Tip O'Neill statement, all politics is local, is dead right. But in Australia, all politics is more local than in most other countries. What I find worrying is the tendency for some ministers, some of the time, to sound off basically for domestic purposes, to sound big, chest-beating, you know, tough, we'll look after you, don't you worry, all this stuff, when really, you know, the language they're using and the actions they're taking are simply not in our interest. They're going to bring repercussions. And I'm perfectly prepared to understand that certain things will bring repercussions, and we have to act in the national interest, and we have to act in the national interest and explain it, you know, quite seriously when those interests are really affected. What I object to is superfluous statements at the political level which cause us damage. It's basically bad for the country.
You're saying don't lead with the chin, which is obviously, I mean, the population is a bit frightened, wouldn't you say, at the moment? The world appears to be, it's under immense pressure with the pandemic, and it's shifting on its axis in a range of ways, partly as a result of America's change and China's change. So it is tricky, sort of encouraging people to calm down and work out what is in our national interest.
Obviously, the world is a dangerous place, and clearly the changes with China are of huge importance to Australia, and they are creating a different region to that which we have lived with since the Second World War. That is enormously important. Arguably, it is an existential question for Australia. And we should be on notice that we're facing a very different world. It is quite another thing to create phobias in the country. And I sense that that's happening. And I think it's very dangerous. I think it is just as dangerous to create phobias in a country, to beat the drums of war, to invoke the dogs of war, to do all those things, when really people need to be looking at the national interest in a calm, considered and courageous way. They're two very different things, and I think we have gone too far in the other direction.
Just shifting to exemplars for you of this craft of yours, diplomacy, who has struck you in both your experience and your reading?
Look, the three people who've made the biggest impact on me personally are all Southeast Asians with whom I've dealt. One was a Vietnamese in the 80s called Nguyen Co Thach, who was a highly intelligent and agile Vietnamese foreign minister. The second was a civilian, a non-politician in Thailand, who twice became prime minister to get over crises, a man called Anan Panyarachun, And I think the third, who will be much better known probably to most Australians, was Ali Alatas, who, along with Tuck, was certainly the most skillful foreign minister that I've ever come across.
Interesting. What can diplomacy not achieve? Let me ask you that. What were the limits that you learned?
Oh, look, the politics are against you. It's very tough. What you can do as an able diplomat, I think, is when the politics are beginning to veer in your own direction, you can take advantage of it. Let me give you an example. The big Australian diplomatic achievements were, I think, at the time of Gareth Evans, and that's partly in praise of him, but it's partly the point I really want to make is it was in the period between the fall of the Soviet Union and 9/11. And over that 10 years, the world was shifting. And that's when we were able to achieve the Cambodia breakthrough. It was Gareth and Michael Costello, and later on, John Sanderson was the general running that exercise. Now, that was a classic case of effective Australian diplomacy when the politics were with you. It wouldn't have been possible 5 years earlier, and it wouldn't have been possible probably for different reasons 5 years later. And so, you know, that is a crucial aspect. Look, another case is the Antarctic Environment Treaty, which I was involved in. Bob Hawke changed our position along with the French, you know, against everybody else. Now, we were able to bring about a new treaty because of the actions of the green groups, the environmental groups on the Antarctic. If they hadn't swung right behind us, we would have been two countries against about 60, and we wouldn't have been able to bring it off. So it's a question of, you know, the politics, I think, being with you, and the politics against you, it's very tough. Second point I think I'd like to make is bear in mind that diplomacy doesn't usually, on serious issues, take place in a vacuum. On security issues, a lot depends on the military structure around a particular issue. And diplomacy and military power work hand in hand. And that's, you're seeing a classic example of that right now in the relationship between China and the United States. So it is often part of something much wider. Equally, on trade issues, diplomacy goes with what business wants at the time and also with the economic conditions of the time. So diplomacy depends on circumstances, but it also plays in with all the other equities in the picture at the time.
Could I maybe ask you a final recommendation for the best reading you might recommend to listeners to understand it better? Have you got any favourites?
Yeah, I guess I have. I think you really have to start with Allen Gingell's book, Fear of Abandonment, which sets out really the history of Australia's foreign relations from the Second World War till today. So, you know, I think that's pretty crucial reading if you're an Australian interested in Australian foreign policy. You know, there's a plethora of stuff, of course, to read beyond that. But I suggest two things. One, people read a bit about international relations and how they work, but also get to know the history and the way countries around us actually work. And those are sort of different sciences, really. So you could read Kissinger on diplomacy, which is still a classic, but also, you know, read books on China, books on Indonesia. I mean, for example, Richard McGregor of the Lowy Institute has written some very good stuff on China. So, you know, but there are plenty of people on China. The other one just I recommend because it's so intriguing is the biography of Richard Holbrooke called Our Man by an American called George Packer. Now, Holbrooke was a sort of very strange diplomat, robust, but very, very effective in his own way, but a complicated character. But why I recommend this, it shows diplomacy in practice. But it's so readable because of this extraordinary character who is the centre of the book.
John McCarthy, thank you so much for kicking us off in our series.
You're most welcome.
John McCarthy, a long-serving diplomat holding ambassadorship positions in a range of places, the US, Indonesia, Japan, High Commissioner to India, in Vietnam and Mexico.